The Midnight Myth Podcast presents The Wheel of Ka, an exploration into the writings of Stephen King. What started as two friends rereading The Dark Tower has turned into an exploration of Stephen King's writing writ large. This month, we record Eyes of the Dragon. Say thank you, Sai.
Peter, destroy this after you've read it. I don't believe you did it. Others feel the same, I'm sure. I am still your friend. I love you as I always did. Dennis does not believe it either. If I can ever help, get to me through Pena. Let your heart be steadfast. As he read this, Peter's eyes filled with warm tears of gratitude. I think that real friendship always makes us feel such sweet gratitude, because the world almost always seems like a very hard desert, and the flowers that grow there seem to grow against such high odds. Good old Ben, he whispered over and over again. In the fullness of his heart, he couldn't think to say anything else. Good old Ben. Good old Ben. For the first time, he began to think that his plan, wild and dangerous as it was, might have a chance of succeeding. Next, he thought of the note. Ben had put his life on the line to write it. Ben was noble, barely, but not royal, thus not immune from the headsman's axe. If Besson or one of his jackals found this note, they would guess that one or the other of the boys who had brought the dollhouse must have written it. The loudish one looked as if he couldn't read even the largest letters in a child's book, let alone read such tiny ones as these. So they would look for the other boy, and from there to the chopping block might be a short trip for good old Ben. He could think of only one sure way to get rid of it, and he didn't hesitate. He crumpled the little note up between his thumb and forefinger of his right hand and ate it.
Fellow travelers on the path of the beam, Wheel of Ka is back.
As we say in the theater, we're back.
We are back,
we're
baby.
We're back.
We have just finished reading Eyes of the Dragon by Stephen King. We are here to analyze and dissect and discuss. We will discuss the book, how it relates to The Dark Tower.
Yes.
And The Path of the Beam, which we are all on, and just the book writ large. I'm really excited to be back here. It feels like every time we do this, it's been a lifetime since we've done
right.
it. But it's been like 4.5 weeks, really. Like, it hasn't been a lifetime. But Steve, man, how you feeling?
Oh, I feel great today. I've had a good week so far. I've worked out 3 days in a row doing the Muay Thai, which feels great. I got to make music with two really great friends today. I have another podcast dropping on July 26th, Mythic Thunder Loot. For anybody that likes D&D and rock music and comedy, come check that out.
Nobody listening to Wheel of Ka likes those
things.
Oh, nobody.
I bet. No, I feel really good. I'm excited to talk about this one. But I think in a different way than all the other books that we've read, because I had a different reaction to this book, I think, than I have the other ones. But I feel good. I'm always just so happy whenever we do this. I mean, now that you have a kid, I have a baby on the way, which I can announce now. You know, I have Rebecca is pregnant. We're in our second trimester. So I'm using you as a great form of inspiration as a dad, because Derek is an incredible dad.
And a Laurel podcaster.
Yeah, exactly. And Laurel is clearly an incredible mom and a podcaster. So I got a lot to look forward to, man. And I'm just, every time we sit down and do this, I feel great. So I'm really looking forward to it. What about you?
I love it. I love that the quartet is growing.
Oh, by one.
You know, so Laurel and I had Arthur, and now Steve and Rebecca will have your bundle of joy.
Young baby.
Super great. I am feeling really great as well. I'm really excited to talk about this book. There's so much for us to get into and to analyze and dissect. I just also want to say this. Steve has this other podcast, Mythic Thunder Loot, as someone who backed it on, what is it called? Kickstarter.
Yes, thank you.
I got a few more sneak peeks that are available out there on Apple Podcasts. Uh-huh. It's on the Google Play Store too, I
it
assume.
It is, yes.
I would highly recommend if you like gaming, you like music, you like laughing, you like fun, you like good storytelling.
You like ridiculousness?
It is a very well-produced podcast.
Thank you.
It is a Dungeons & Dragons-themed rock opera.
Yeah, rock musical. It's a D&D musical podcast. Musical.
Need we say any more?
I know, right? Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, now let's talk a little Eyes of the Dragon. Oh, let's hit us up it. On Twitter. We have an at Wheel of Cod Twitter.
Yes, we do. Yes, and I was super active on it for a while and then life. But I plan to be more active moving forward. So, yes, it's at Wheel of Cod. Please hit us up. We're going to put probably another poll up because we have to do the next book. So we would really like to know your thoughts and feelings about what book you'd like for us to read next.
Yeah, just a little bit how the sausage is made. After we did The Dark Tower, Steve and I knew the next book had to be Salem's Lot. We just felt it intuitively, the way that Roland intuits through a tough situation and mm-hmm. comes out ahead. Then we put the poll out there in which there was a tie between it and Insomnia.
Yep.
It went to a runoff, Insomnia won. So we figured let's do it next. And then we realized after doing Insomnia and It, which were really big books, we wanted to do a smaller book.
Yeah.
So we did Eyes of the Dragon.
Yeah,
we
just picked this one, didn't we? We didn't ask.
We did not ask.
We just picked this one.
But we are going to do a listener poll about the next Stephen King book. If you want us to read a book or add it to the poll, mm-hmm. hit us up on Twitter at Wheel of Ka or The Midnight Myth, which is the parent podcast of The Wheel of Ka.
Yeah.
So at Midnight Myth on Twitter. I think that's the best way to dialogue with us.
Oh, yeah, and let us know, because we take those very seriously and highly into consideration. So if there's something that you want to hear, let us know.
For example, Insomnia was recommended by a Twitter user to put in the poll.
Yeah.
And we put it in the poll and then read the book, which wasn't even on either of our radars.
No, not at all.
Because we have both read The Dark Tower twice, but we're still total Stephen King noobs.
It's true. This is very true.
Most of this stuff we had not done before. So, long story short, thank you for listening. Mm-hmm. Let's start with, I'll read the back here of Eyes of the Dragon.
Yes.
Thus begins one of the most epic tales that master storyteller Stephen King has ever written. A captivating fantasy of dark magic and the struggle for absolute power that utterly transforms the destinies of two brothers born into royalty. Through this enthralling masterpiece of mythical adventure, intrigue, and terror, readers will thrill to this unforgettable narrative with the relentless, wicked enchantment and the most terrible of secrets. Mm-hmm. This book is about Delane, the
yes.
country of Delane, with King Roland, who has a court magician named Flag, who is actually a magician mm-hmm. or sorcerer, mm-hmm. and the king's magician. He secretly kills the queen because she was working against him, and he kills the king and frames his oldest son, Peter, for the murder mm-hmm. so that the weaker son, Thomas, can ascend to the throne and Flag can rule through Thomas. And Flag's goal is to destroy the kingdom, simply to destroy it.
Yep.
Peter, imprisoned eventually with the help of friends, he escapes. He escapes with his friend Ben and Ben's ally, Naomi, and Peter's old butler, Dennis, are all working to help get Peter out, where Peter ends up then confronting Flag in Roland's old study, where Thomas is there channeling the spirit of his father. Thomas being the only witness through the eyes of the dragon that King Roland had killed, witnessing Flag poisoning the King Roland, gets up, grabs a sandalwood arrow, shoots it true at Flag's eye, and Flag disappears. Now, all is right. Peter is reinstituted as the king, and then Thomas decides with the butler, Dennis, that they are going to go on a quest to finally hunt down and kill the villain, Flag.
You know, I really wish that everybody at home could watch us record this, because every time you do a recap, I'm just like, like I know it's going to be good.
This was an easy one to recap compared to other Stephen King books.
Yeah, but like, I don't remember half of what you just said. Like, I don't remember the beginning of the book as well as you do. Maybe I shouldn't say that out loud.
I mean, other, you probably shouldn't. Credibility crushed. Podcast numbers was, down.
Again, you crushed it.
Other things worth noting that Sasha, the queen, uh-huh. had a dollhouse before she married King Roland. And King Roland knew that Sasha missed her dollhouse, so had a new one built. Mm-hmm. And when Peter is imprisoned, he asks the judge, Peña, if Peña would grant him two little favors. One, a napkin.
Yep.
And two, his mother's dollhouse, which has a full spinster rope-making apparatus in it. And he picks threads of the napkins Genius. And makes a rope and uses the rope to escape the needle.
Such patience. Such patience.
I mean, Peter is a boss.
Yeah, he is.
Tell me, Steve, in terms of the Stephen King canon, when did this book come out?
Yeah.
Where does it relate to the other books in the tower?
Sure. So this was originally released in 1984. And then there was another kind of like mass market production in 1987, which I believe is the version that we read. And it had a couple other, you know, it had a couple other iterations, and at the time of publication, apparently it was like a really, it was a deviation, for the norm from King, obviously who was best known for horror. Apparently the book is a work of epic fantasy. According to Wikipedia, it says an epic fantasy in a quasi-medieval setting with a clearly established battle between good and evil and magic playing a lead role. The Eyes of the Dragon was originally titled The Napkins, and we will talk about that. At first, I remember when Rebecca, because my wife read this book before we did, because she's doing something separately from this podcast. She's reading Stephen King novels in chronological order. And so, you know, when she was like, oh, and do you know why it's called Napkins? I was like, no, I have no idea. Napkins. I've read the first 100 pages of this book. And she was like, oh, it'll make sense. And it absolutely does make sense. So again, released in 1984, it had some decent reception at first. I mean, it was warmly received by critics. Apparently Barbara Tritel of the New York Times described the Eyes of the Dragon as, quote, drawing clear influence from European fairy tales, and wrote that the novel was, quote, more elegant than any other novel Mr. King has written so far. However, now that was critical acclaim. His fans hated it. They didn't think that there was enough horror. They thought it was particularly geared towards children, which, it was. He wrote it for his kids, which there's nothing wrong with. But his fans panned it. And according to Wikipedia, now I don't know how true this is. Take it for what you will, but I think this is a really interesting nugget that apparently all of the criticism that Stephen King and all the flack that he got for this book is what inspired him to write Misery. And so if anybody knows Misery, the film or the book, it's about this, you know, this romance novelist who kills off his lead character so that he can expand his writing. And so he gets kidnapped by, spoiler alert, gets kidnapped by one of his fans who's insane. I won't say what happens. And then apparently this book and the criticism he got because he tried to branch out caused him to write fucking Misery, dude. That's insane.
That tells you that fans have been toxic for a really long time.
Forever. So that's a little background of the book. yeah. He really liked it. You know, he really enjoyed writing it, apparently. And he wrote it for his kids, which I think comes through pretty clearly.
Yeah, I do think that compared to especially the journey we've been on, we've read The Tower, Salem's Lot, It, Insomnia.
Oh, yeah.
Linguistically, thematically.
This is light.
It is a much easier read.
Yeah.
It is shorter. B, it's written on paper with bigger font.
It's only like 300 and some pages, right?
And it does have a sort of young adult feel to the language.
At least when it starts, I think it does.
And I don't say that in any way, shape, or form disparagingly.
No.
I think young adult can be great works of art. But it is it's very different.
Oh, it's wildly different.
And The Dark Tower in particular. And yeah. Insomnia. But the reason I think Well, let me tell you my personal story with Eyes of the Dragon. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
I've said this on the main Midnight Myth podcast feed. I don't know if I've said this in Wheel of Ka. If I have, I'm going to tread some water. But I'm dyslexic, which means reading comprehension is not one of my strong suits. One of the reasons I'm such an avid reader as an adult is simply compensation for the fact that it took me a long time to read it. And now that I'm good at it, I really like doing it because,
for sure,
you know, I have to make up with the fact that it's an inadequacy that I have in me. Well, when I was a boy, the first thing that I started to read was comic books, then Dungeons and Dragons books.
Sure.
Those were the things that I could kind of manage. Comic books, because there were mostly pictures.
Yep.
And Dungeons and Dragons was like, I wanted to play the game.
Right.
This thrilled my parents that I showed an interest of reading for the first time ever. And my mom suggested I read The Hobbit. Mm. And I loved it. Mm-hmm. It was the first book I ever read and enjoyed.
Wow.
The next book was...
This makes a lot of sense.
The next book was Eyes of the Dragon.
Oh,
my
mom
suggested that I read it. And I liked Eyes of the Dragon, but I didn't fully get all of it.
Sure.
And I didn't enjoy it as much, but it definitely warmed me up for my next reading project, which was Lord of the Rings. And then by the time I was done with Lord of the Rings, I was a reader.
No kidding.
And the Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit loomed large. I have since read them several, several times. There have been movies that have come out, but Eyes of the Dragon kind of sat back in my subconscious, almost like a little memory from childhood that you'd rather not remember.
Sure.
Knowing that, like, I had read it, but I was so young, and I knew there was a character, Flag, and I knew that this Flag character made an imprint on me, because when I played Dungeons and Dragons, every evil wizard character I created was Flag.
Sure.
So the character Flag loomed large, but the rest of the book kind of fizzled out of my memory.
Interesting. That's it. Okay.
Now, coming back to it as an adult, I have, especially as an adult, Stephen King, new constant reader, Dark Towerist to the core.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed and felt like in my Stephen King journey, I needed this refreshing break from the heavy horror. I needed this lighter feel. I needed to be reminded about what it is to be a kid again. Mm-hmm. I needed to remind myself that fantasy can be both sophisticated and playful, that it can be easy to read, but thought-provoking all the same.
Yeah.
And really enjoyed the read.
See, this is what happens. I have my specific feelings about it, and then you end up going first, and then I'm like, damn, Derek, that's a really good way to put it. That is a really good way to put it, because me, I am a freak, and I crave that drama as an actor, as a performer. I crave, like, I wanted this book to be a little bit more dramatic than it is, and I'm not going to say that I didn't enjoy it. And you and I have talked about this quite a few times. In fact, I think we've checked in with each other a little bit more with this book than the other ones, because the other ones, I was just so engrossed, I wasn't even thinking about it. But with this one, I remember asking you specifically, like, hey, are you enjoying this? And you were like, I love it. I'm eating it up. I think it's great. And I was like, oh, I'm like, it's good. But I'm not eating it up the same way that I had the other books connected to the tower until probably the last, I don't know, 80 pages of the book. And then it really kicked in for when I could start to see the similarities between the Dark Tower and the Quartet and the characters in both books. I just think it took me a little bit to get there. And then once I got there, I was like, okay, I buy into this.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Of course.
Was it the similarities to the tower that got you into this book? Which is to say, if you hadn't read the tower, do you think you would like this book?
I mean, that's a good question. I think I would have enjoyed it as a fantasy story because it is an interesting story. He's not trying to do anything wildly different. You know, he's not deviating from the tradition of an adventure fantasy or an epic fantasy. I wouldn't call it an epic fantasy. I think that The Dark Tower is an epic fantasy. I think this is an adventure fantasy book, if we're getting technical. But if I hadn't read The Tower, this would have been a fun adventure book. But because I've read The Tower, I think that's what kept my interest, are the similarities, the mirrors, the things that you can relate to in both stories. I know there's something very specific we're going to talk about later in the quartets that really made me interested in this book. But I would say if I hadn't read The Tower, I might have liked it a little better, actually, because I would have treated it as its own standalone piece, as opposed to thinking about it as a direct connection to The Tower, because then I put this really unfair expectation around it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, you know, you kind of had parallel tracks of thought there. At one point you were saying, you know, hey, it's The Tower that saved this book. And another point you're saying, well, it actually kind of ruined it too,
and
which
I
is
know.
Okay. That's fire.
And
that's
what's
fine.
Funny is that those are the things I felt, both of those feelings while reading the book. So yeah, it's a very convoluted way of saying yes and no.
I really respect that, because we're analyzing art. You know, one thing that is very different about this book from like super big picture perspective compared to the other ones we've done on this podcast, I would argue all of the books we've read thus far are postmodernist works of art. Mm. And this one is not.
Yeah.
This one is in the vein of fairy tale. It's in the vein of epic fantasy, adventure fantasy. It's very sincere.
Yeah.
In its telling. And in that respect, it stands alone, because you're always waiting for the rug to pull out from you with Stephen King. When's the unexpected thing going to happen? When is the subversion going to happen?
Yeah.
When is the trope going to be exposed for the stupidity that it is? Yet in this one, it doesn't really happen.
No.
Peter,
no, it doesn't.
is the good king. Flag is the evil wizard.
Yeah.
Thomas, the one difference is between other stories involving palace intrigue and an evil manipulator pushing someone to usurp the throne. A very old story. Macbeth deals with that.
Yep.
There are stories, Game of Thrones deals with that, but there are stories going back to Oedipus.
Yeah.
About the unseating of the king for the unrightful king to take it as an inversion of the right order. And there's usually some manipulative, malevolent force doing that.
Absolutely.
The thing that makes this one different from those is that the character Thomas doesn't want the throne. Mm-hmm. The character Thomas is thrust through the story.
He's very reluctant.
Rather than him taking a role in his fate, mm-hmm. fate is guiding him through it. And I think that's very different. Most usurpers want the throne. Thomas is unique in that he doesn't. And to me, that's the reason Thomas can be redeemed.
You know, and he knows for a fact that he's not made for that position. He's almost more self-aware than anyone. You know, honestly, I mean, he realizes at a very early age, no, that's Peter. This is not for me at all. The other thing I would say that is different about this book is that there is a narrator, and that there is a voice that is giving an opinion while telling us this tale, and also leaving room and asking us as the reader to make our own decisions on the judgment that the narrator has passed on these characters. And what I found really interesting about the book was that the use of that voice, like, oh, I don't know, like, do I believe this? Am I supposed to take this seriously? And honestly, the use of that narrator voice to me feels very King-like, though. Because I almost felt that the narrator was a little tongue-in-cheek, like, oh, I mean, I'm telling you this, but you make your own decision. And to me, I spent some time like, who is the narrator of the story? Is this just a random person? You know, what voice is this? But I really do like that, you know, literary device of using the narrator and then allowing the narrator to say to the audience, well, you make your own choice. I've given you this piece of information. You decide what's right and what's wrong.
Can I pull a quote here that point I want to
always, yeah.
I want to highlight that point because I think it's an interesting one. Now let many long years pass, all in a twinkling. One of the great things about tales is how fast time may pass when not much of a notice is happening. Real life is never that way. It's probably a good thing. Time only passes faster in histories. And what is a history except a grand sort of tale where passing centuries are substituted for passing years?
Mm.
And I think this is a point where the narrator is conscious of the idea that, one, there is an element of storytelling in history itself, mm-hmm. which as a lifelong student of history, I 100% agree with.
Absolutely.
If you write the greatest history of all time and nobody likes to read it because it's boring, you did a bad job.
Yeah, of course.
The reason history is interesting is because you got to put a little bit of story.
Put some drama.
It is a part of what, but there's a reason that Shakespeare's histories live on better than Tacitus's, you know, and that's because he redid it Shakespeare.
Like so who?
Exactly.
And I was a theater student. Who?
Tacitus is one of the great Roman historians. But
long story short,
I think the narrator being involved to me evokes a sense of I'm sitting around the fire.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting next to a gunslinger close to a thinny. Mm. And the story is being told.
Sure.
And I'm actually now in this story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the narrator is guiding me through and giving their reflections, much in the way the book Wizard in Glass works.
See, this is why I like the fact that you and I don't talk about the book while we read it. That like we get together a little bit before we record, but that you and I really don't discuss the book while we're reading it. Because I would have never looked at it that way.
Yeah.
And that's such an interesting way to look at that narrator character. Because now I can see it. I can already see the scene. It reminds me of the palaver that the Man in Black and Roland have, you know, at the very end of The Gunslinger. And that this is just another way of the Man in Black telling this story to Roland, you know?
And that storytelling is itself an act of creation?
Absolutely it is.
And the narrator is there, and the narrator is non-judgmental in nature mm-hmm. in many parts is really interesting.
Yeah.
As to say, I can tell you this is what happened.
But you have to make your own decision.
You've got to figure out if it's good, bad, or in between.
Which means he makes you work. You know, he makes the reader work.
Absolutely. And in this respect, I think it's unique in that it's, to me, if someone were to say, Derek, what is the genre of Eyes of the Dragon? If I had to say, I'd say fairy tale. I don't think it...
Sure.
Now, the difference between a fairy tale, a folklore, a myth, and fantasy, all of those things kind of blur. They're not clear lines in my view. But to me, this feels more like a campfire fairy tale than anything else.
Interesting. Can you elaborate on that a little more?
Well, so fairy tales are usually moral parables. We predominantly link them with Disney right now because sure. Disney took a bunch of particularly Germanic fairy tales mm-hmm. and Scandinavian fairy tales and they turned them into their Disney movies.
Right.
Largely because they were part of the public domain so that they could just grab those stories and adapt them. It was very capitalistic in why they chose those stories rather than any others. But generally speaking, that's what we think of those stories. This is Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. This is the Little Mermaid. These are the Grimms, the Hans Christian Andersens.
Right.
Those stories are typically foundational myths. They are about an aspect of a culture or a people that are usually telling a moral lesson for the young. They typically sum up to the world is hostile and threatening, and you're going to have to fight your way through it.
Interesting.
It's a way to tell children that the world is really not a good place yeah. and a hostile place.
Yeah.
Think of Red Riding Hood.
Sure.
Think of that fairy tale of Red Riding Hood. This is a young woman in the woods by herself on a journey to do something really nice, and she gets killed because of it.
Yeah.
Depending on the version of the story. The original story.
Well, that's the original. Yeah, the Grimm. I mean,
she dies.
Yeah.
Yeah, she gets eaten by the wolf.
There's one
and
where
dies.
Like a kid's feet get cut off. It's like they're intense.
And so there's
those Germanic tribes.
This is the idea that the world is hostile and threatening. Now, why I say this is a fairy tale is that the fairy tale exists until you have people writing them down as an oral tradition. Mm-hmm. These are stories that were passed down, much like the myths and legends of old. And this feel, because there's a narrator talking to us that's almost a character, it has the feeling of an oral tradition of someone just telling the story around the campfire.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And to me, it has a feel of the fairy tale in it, more so than any other kind of genre, keeping the caveat that these genres do blur.
Sure. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, I definitely, and I think this is maybe it being a fairy tale is where people thought like, oh, this is young adult, or oh, it's not as elaborate. It's not as intricate. It's not as detailed. It's not as dramatic as what King normally writes. And it's like, well, who cares? It's plenty dramatic. A lot happens in this book.
A magician has a poison so powerful that a grain of sand can poison
right.
a rat.
Kills a king.
And then he's like charging with an axe up the tower.
You got a 15-year-old boy locked at the top of a tower who's taking napkins and making a rope for himself. I mean, you know, it may not be, you know, vampires taking over Salem's Lot. It may not be, you know, a killer clown who's abducting children. Like, it may not be those things. But I still think there are certain pieces of this book that feel like horror. And especially when it comes to Flag. Without any question.
Yo, Flag with a battle axe running up the stairs
screaming
of the needle.
And like laughing. Typical. It's what we're used to.
The two-headed parrot that Flag has. That's pretty horror, man.
It reminds me of Lud. It reminds me like so much of Lud.
Let's talk about some tower references.
Let's do it. Next section.
So let's relate this.
Seamless.
Yeah, good segue.
Seamless.
So let's talk about the relation that this book has to the tower, the references. You want to take a lead? What do you got?
Yeah, I mean, right off the bat, the easy ones are Roland, the name of the king. Clearly, Randall Flagg. My biggest one that I made to the tower connection, outside of the obvious ones of the needle, clearly the tower. The one that I really connected to were, I always forget the character names. It's Dennis and what's the dog's name?
Frisky.
And then the other two,
Ben, the best friend, and Naomi.
And Naomi clearly remind me of Eddie, Susanna, Jake, and Oi. They are the quartet. Immediately when I read that, I was like, oh, we're back home. And, you know, this quest for power, Flag is clearly represents the Randall Flag that's in the stand. Martin, the Randall Flag that we know in Different King. I mean, he's obviously the man in black, or supposed to represent what that is, at least. And those are like the main, oh, well, then we have Thomas at the very end leaving with Dennis to go on this quest to chase after Flag, which reminds me a lot of Roland, obviously.
And that Thomas's arrow is made of sandalwood.
Yes, that's the one I always forget that you remind me of. That's always, yes, yes.
He grabs his father's arrow, made of sandalwood.
Yes.
His aim is true.
He's a dead shot.
He becomes a gunslinger.
How do I forget that part?
And he's also, Thomas is not the smartest.
No.
The way that Roland is not
exactly.
the smartest.
Yes.
You know, though not stupid, but not the smartest.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. I love all of those. A few things to add to it. When Peter is escaping in the snowstorm, the church roof rips off next to the church tower. So like a symbolic tower falls.
Yeah, the tower collapses. Yep.
As Peter is trying to escape his tower, as a symbol of the tower. And yeah. I think those are the two main, like, direct Dark Tower symbols.
Sure.
I do want to talk a little bit about Flag, his nature, versus the other iterations. But before to do that, a few little, these are really granular things that I picked out that I thought were interesting.
Oh, hit me.
So here's a quote. This is right in the beginning. All the drawing paper he wanted in a time on paper was extremely hard to make, and only wealthy people could afford to have it. The idea that paper is rare.
Yes.
It's a lot like Midworld, that paper is really valuable and rare. Yes,
absolutely.
So that was what I picked out that I'm like, okay, this is great. This makes me really think of, like, is Delane in Midworld? More on that later. Mm. And then, okay, this one is also a deep reference. Outside the windscreen, I'm sorry, hold on, let me start over. Outside the windscreen garbled, old wives cringed in their beds and slept poorly and told their husbands that Rhiannon, the dark witch of the coups, was riding her hateful broom this night.
Yep.
And we could work, blah, 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 blah. I'm messing it up.
Rhea
of the coups
is back.
And I'm like, oh man, there's a dark witch of the coups in this.
There's somebody out there going to listen to this and be like, yeah, guys, exactly. For you and I, it's like these members like, yeah, that's why you read the book.
All right, let me talk a little bit about Cock.
Yeah, hit it. Let's go.
I'm going to talk a little bit about Cock because it's a wheel, and I'm going to tell everyone just an interesting experience I had reading this book. So I have all of the Dark Tower audiobooks.
Oh, right.
Yeah, all of them.
Yeah.
And recently had been changing my work schedule and commuting more. So I'd been in my car more, and I'd caught up on all my podcasts. I had caught up on everything. I was like, you know what? Why don't I put a Dark Tower book on?
Why not?
So I put on The Drawing of the Three. Now, here's the interesting thing. The Drawing of the Three is not my favorite Dark Tower book. If I was going to pick one randomly, why pick that one? No idea why, except I think Ka guided me. Mm. And as I am listening to The Drawing of the Three, off and on, here and there, a little bit, we come to yesterday, where I get to the point where, in The Drawing of the Three, Roland is inhabiting the body of Jack Mort. And he is going to get the Keflex, the penicillin he needs, to cure himself of the disease, the venom of the Lobstrosities. And he walks in to the pharmacy and thinks to himself, this is not what he thought. He had seen lots of magicians. He was expecting cauldrons. He was expecting secret men with dark robes brewing potions and couldn't believe what he saw. And he thought about the magicians in his life. And he thought about his pursuit of Walter, the man in black, the way that Martin had slept with his mother and orchestrated what he thought would be Roland's banishment to the West, which did not work. And then he thinks of that time he met Thomas and Dennis and that evil magician Flag who turned a man into a dog.
See, this is the craziest thing, right? Is that you and I have either read or listened through The Dark Tower twice. But what we haven't done, clearly, is read all the other novels. And so there are references, like this one, throughout the Dark Tower series that we don't even know, that we're learning about.
And this blew me away. I was walking back from the store with a Gatorade and a bag of chips, and I almost dropped them.
Oh, I bet.
And I put them down on the ground, and I texted Steve, oh my God, I'm listening to The Drawing of the Three.
Yeah.
And the characters, this was yesterday that this happened. So, like, Ka is a wheel.
Absolutely.
It has come around full circle. I happened to pick The Drawing of the Three, which I would have rated at one of, I love the book, but one of my least favorite of the Dark Tower.
Really?
I love the book. Oh, that's I love them all.
That's interesting.
You know, but it's no Wolves of the Cala, right? It's no Wastelands. You know, so I would put it on the lower side of all of them. But for whatever reason, I can't tell you why, except for Ka, that I chose it. And here I have the heroes of this book showing up in that book. And it made me think really about the nature of the character Flag. If we relate this to the tower, Flag and Roland have met. Martin and Roland have met. Walter and Roland have met. The Dark Tower coalesces that Martin and Walter are probably the same person.
Right.
But here's a thing that's a little complicated in the eyes of the dragon. The character Flag in the eyes of the dragon goes at length saying he doesn't know how to shape change. Makes specific points to be like, there are a few limitations to magic. One of those limitations is shape changing.
At that level of the tower.
And should Roland have met Flag with Dennis and Thomas, the presumption is in that backstory that he defeated Flag. Is this Flag the Man in Black?
That's a great question. Again, this always happens. Every episode, you break my brain. I mean, yes and no. I think it's a complicated question because I think... Because is it also the Randall Flag that's in the stand? You know, like, is this the same representation? I don't know. I don't think it's the same person. But I do think it's the same concept. And I think this concept of the magician, the concept of the trickster, which is very popular right now, clearly with the Loki series and with other things that are happening in, you know, in and around the world. This idea of a trickster is very popular. And I don't think it's meant to be the same, but I do think it's meant to be similar. I think there's a reason why he names him Flag. I don't know. Are they the same person? Maybe not. But I do think they represent the same ideal.
I think that's very correct. Mm-hmm. Whether or not Flag, Walter, Martin are literally the same person, they are archetypally the same.
And they could be. I mean, they very well could be, because the Man in Black that we know in the Dark Tower is super powerful to a point where maybe this story, he's not as powerful. I don't know. So much ambiguity surrounds the Man in Black. That because he's played so many other roles, especially in the Dark Tower, it's hard sometimes to pinpoint what the truth is surrounding him.
And I like that you call him a trickster, because I think that's the right way to think about this archetype that King has in so many of the nemesises.
Yeah.
There are these characters in King books that destroy to destroy. The satisfaction they get is at the act of destroying what King would call the white, the order, that there is a sort of cosmic significance to how we organize ourselves, and that there are these tricksters that pop up and their only aim is to tear it down, not to rebuild, not to make something better, but to just tear it the fuck down.
Some people just love to watch the world burn.
Like Nero watching Rome, like Donald Trump being our president.
Right.
Like this trickster energy is everywhere. Like I'm going to be, it's about me.
Right.
The universe is centered around me and what I want. And what I want is destruction, not for the sake of rebuilding, because destruction can be a creative act.
Sure.
You sometimes do have to destroy things to rebuild. Think of, I don't know, slavery.
Yeah.
Had to be destroyed to be rebuilt.
Right.
So there are moments and times where things must be destroyed, but the trickster destroys simply to destroy.
Yeah. Watches suffering for suffering's sake. Enjoys suffering.
Like when Flag watches Thomas, I think he kills a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And Flag's just like, oh, yeah, that's my boy.
Yeah.
He's killing a dog. I like him.
Ugh. Flag. It's gross.
And I think whether or not they're literally the same or symbolically the same is kind of not the point too.
Yeah, definitely.
Because they could be literally the same. But it could also be that Flag is just the name of this trickster energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's legit. I also think that both things apply. I think this is definitely a yes and situation. Like, yes, they could be literal because he uses the same spelling. That, you know, it's clearly a reference if you've read other books to a different character that he's written about. And I don't think Stephen King is, I don't think he's trying to hide it. I think he's being very blatant and very specific and wants us to make these connections as readers. Because the only way you're going to make the connection is if you've read The Tower. Right? Otherwise, it's just a fantasy novel. And you'll recognize a couple characters here and there. But I also think it's interesting, like, talking on this same level about the fact that because he got so much criticism for this, that it inspired him to write one of his best books.
Yeah, you know, I think we have to put Misery on the poll then.
I think so.
For the next book.
Yeah, because apparently.
Knowing that Misery and the Eyes of the Dragon are connected, I feel like we should throw that out there.
You know, I just watched the movie like 3 or 4 months ago during the pandemic with Rebecca.
That's crazy.
For Laurel the first and I time, did
the, I know. The same thing.
It was so good.
It's a great movie.
Kathy Bates, James Caan, stupid.
And really, really scary.
It's intense.
It really holds
it's
up
intense.
Well. It's a very good movie, which is a whole topic for another podcast.
Another day.
Why do Stephen King's works make such poor adaptations?
That'd be a great conversation for us to have.
We should.
Pin that for later.
Yeah, I just finished Lisey's Story on Apple TV Plus.
Mm.
And I have thoughts.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Sure.
But I have thoughts. Anyway, we've talked a little bit about Flag. Shall we pivot our attention to Peter a little
sure.
bit? Would you like to talk about Peter's character?
Yeah, I mean, you have your pretty stereotypical prince who is... I mean, I say stereotypical except for the fact that he really embodies what a king is. And you can see it at a very early age in Peter, especially that scene, you know, with the head of the stables with this horse that's limp and the decision that's made. And that not only is he a strong leader, but he's also a very compassionate leader. And I think what scares Flag about that is that people who are empathetic and compassionate carry a lot of power because empathy is very powerful. And I think to those who want to just watch the world burn and destroy things just to destroy, like Flag, are incredibly scared and intimidated and frightened by empathy, by being able to just be in somebody else's shoes and be able to connect with them in a sympathetic way.
I think that's really well said, and I agree wholeheartedly. The only thing I'll add on top of that, when you look at the functionality of Peter, who is smart, capable, he is empathetic, and then you look at the dysfunctionality of Thomas, you get the sense that the common denominator is that Peter had Sasha. Peter had a good mom.
Yeah.
And even though they mentioned in there that even though they were like, you're the queen, you don't have to raise him, we could do this, that Sasha was just like, no.
It's my son.
My son will be king one day.
Yeah.
And he's going to know his manners.
Yeah, and Thomas did not have that. And in fact, Thomas had no parents because Roland might as well have been non-existent as far as he's concerned.
And Thomas didn't have that. Because Flag murdered Sasha.
It's insane.
He inspired the midwife to make a cut that would ultimately let her bleed to death after she gave birth.
Yeah, he's despicable.
And because Thomas is ripped of the maternal that really helped make Peter the compassionate and nice person that he is, Thomas really gets left out because Roland is not a good father.
He's an awful father.
To either of them.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for Sasha's influence, Peter could have easily been a Thomas.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that's the common denominator between them, or the uncommon denominator between them, is that, you know, one had a really good, powerful maternal guidance, yeah. maternal hand, and maternal love where one didn't.
Right.
And so Peter is able to be empathetic and kind, even though he's powerful, because his mom was just like, no, you respect everyone. You have good manners.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. And even Roland, I mean, when Roland was a happier person, clearly when Sasha was around and alive, you know, they put all of their energy into Peter. And so Thomas has nobody. I mean, Thomas doesn't even have the respect of the people within the kingdom. You know, I mean, he really, truly is looked at as third, fourth class, underrated.
Thomas the tax bringer.
Exactly. Exactly.
Meanwhile, Peter is imprisoned. I mean, there's some Count of Monte Cristo energy happening here.
1,000%.
When he beats up the jailer.
Oh, it's such a great scene.
And the jailer, before he passes out, calls him a king.
Yeah.
And that to me was like, whoa. That was the tipping point where I'm like, I can't put this book down.
Interesting.
Because I needed to know how Peter was going to escape.
Yeah.
And there was the mystery. Why napkins? Why the dollhouse?
Well, yeah. And that I think the napkins and the dollhouse is really where the novel changed for me. It went from your stereotypical good versus evil to, oh, okay, here are the intricacies of King. Here are the really small, minute details that make the conflict interesting. It's not just a magician, an evil magician kills a king. Because at the end of the day, Roland was also not the best king in the world. I mean, he and Thomas are very similar. They're both drunks. They don't really care. I mean, Roland stopped taking care of himself at all. Was super distant. I mean, again, you know, if your wife is killed, if your queen is killed, a lifelong depression is pretty easy to fall under.
But the difference, too, Roland had Sasha.
Exactly.
Counterbalancing flag.
Thomas has had nothing.
I think the key to understanding this family and this power dynamic is Sasha. I really do.
Yeah, I think that I don't think you're wrong.
And interesting that Sasha's name sounds a little bit like Susan.
I mean, come on.
And a little bit like Susanna.
I mean, come on. We've got Ben is the best friend. Like we know this is something I've wanted for us to speak on for a while, but I think this is a much later discussion for us to have. Like, why does Stephen King constantly use the same first names? Constantly.
And it's interesting because sometimes he goes off the reservation.
Sometimes.
And makes up really weird names.
But when there's a point to be made, there are either similarities in the names, direct references to other names. You know, I think there's something, you know, what's in a name? You know, that.
If you're a writer, a lot. I think it's also worth noting when we think about Thomas, too. Not only did Thomas not have a mother in Sasha, what does Thomas not do that Roland does, which keeps Flag at bay? Roland marries Sasha. And that keeps Flag at bay. That helps make Peter into a mature and competent and polite and empathetic leader. Thomas, not only missing the mother, he doesn't also get the advent of marrying a Sasha.
Sure.
So he is just, it's just him.
Well, it's him and alcohol.
And this evil wizard.
And he just drinks. I mean, it's very clear that Thomas, right off the bat, just gets drunk all day, every day. You know, to deal with the immense amount of weight that's been put on his shoulders.
Absolutely. He's also like the Oedipus complex not made manifest.
Yeah, sure.
Because he helps kill his father through the eyes of the dragon, through the eyes of the serpent. He is complicit in his father's murder. But the whole idea of that complex is to possess the mother. Thomas didn't want to possess anything of his father.
No, not at all.
Not the mother, not the throne, not nothing.
And I think it's so interesting that, like, there are those scenes where Thomas basically drunkenly sleepwalks into that room, you know, and relives that scenario, that moment over and over and over again. And you start to wonder, like, I wonder if Thomas goes into that room every night. and watches his father be murdered every night over and over again.
And one thing that's certain, Dennis would not have acted to help Peter.
Absolutely.
Without Thomas's guilt. Mm-hmm. So Thomas's guilt is part of the reason Peter's able to be free. Thomas is a hard character to pin down.
He is. I agree with you. I agree.
Even the narrator says, like, you know, we're not going to really excuse everything, but we don't hate him, so make up your own mind.
No, I feel bad for him. I mean, I legitimately look at him and feel pity for him. I mean, none of the decisions that Thomas makes in this book are his own, except the very end.
Until he shoots the arrow.
And until he shoots the arrow and decides to leave the kingdom, every decision is made for him. And that's a tough role to be in, especially when you walk around and everybody talks about your brother as basically being a guardian angel. As, I mean, it'd be perfect. Everybody speaks about how great Peter is, how smart Peter is, how handsome Peter is, how great Peter is with people, how great of a king Peter's going to be all the time. I mean, if that's the only thing you hear, now I'm an only child, so I've never experienced this, but if that's the only thing you as a younger sibling hear over and over and over again, I mean, if that were me, my ego would be crushed. Like, what the hell do I have to give to the world if Peter got everything?
Yeah, it's like, it's the sailboat scene.
Yeah.
Where Peter gets top marks in archery.
Yes.
And Thomas carved a sailboat. His dad.
Beautifully.
Roland was just like, good job. When Thomas is walking away, Roland looks at Flag. He's just like, kind of looks like a turd, doesn't it? And it's just like, yo, dude, your son desperately wants your love and affection and is lonely.
And it's like, it's not that hard for Thomas is not asking for very much. In fact, he's asking for the bare minimum. And that attention is not even paid to him. And so in a way, I mean, if I were 13, 14 years old and forced into the responsibility of being a king, first of all, a position I never saw myself in, never thought I would have to deal with, because clearly my brother, my perfect brother that everybody talks about is the one that's going to rise and ascend to being the king. Why the hell should I worry about that? Fuck it. I don't have to worry about that. I'll go live my life and be a weirdo. And then all of a sudden, boom, you wake up and you're fucking king. That's a lot of pressure for somebody who doesn't want that type of pressure.
And it's interesting how Thomas's story mirrors Roland of the Dark Tower.
Yes, oh, so much.
In the respect that there's an evil wizard working against the mother, mm-hmm, to diminish the mother figure, to force Thomas into rituals of manhood,
yep,
before Thomas is ready.
Correct.
And that how Thomas takes the sandalwood grips in a test of manhood finally to attack this evil sorcerer, and how it ends with Thomas going to the quote-unquote White Lands, otherwise the desert.
Exiling himself.
To follow the man in black.
And the gunslinger followed. And again, whether or not King intentionally wrote this to happen this way, I think he did. It feels like we're part of a secret club. You know what I mean? There is that feeling of like, would I have enjoyed this? Going back to the first question in the podcast, the more and more that we talk, I usually think about like what we've already talked about. And this idea, like, would I have enjoyed the book outside of the Dark Tower? Thinking about it right now, after everything we've discussed? No, probably not. I think I enjoyed the book mostly because of its direct correlation or its parallels to the Dark Tower.
I will agree that most of the pleasure I got from this book had something to do with Tower references. And I do think Stephen King gets incredible credit, in my view, for kind of inventing the super fandom with Easter eggs that pay off later that is now very popular.
Yeah, he did the multiverse before it was cool.
He was doing this since the 70s, you know, like, so Stephen King was doing this, like, if you really pay attention, there's a lot of Easter eggs that connect for a long time now. And I think he gets tremendous credit for being one of the first major pop culture universe icons. Where like,
and especially because, I mean, this book came out 20 years before Wizard and Glass. You know, so, or maybe not Wizard and Glass, maybe it's Wolves of the Cowl, was the mid-2000s. But like, this book was 20 years before the tower was even finished. So clearly this, that concept was on Stephen King's mind since the very beginning and for a very long time.
And he is peppering in Tower into everything that he has done.
That's so cool.
It really is.
It's so cool.
And it is. And it's very organic. And it's very much, this is the story. Yeah. Eyes of the Dragon is the story that he wants to tell. And it has connections to the Tower that do pay off at other points and at other times. But the story itself stands on its own. And I think that's amazing. I also think Eyes of the Dragon is interesting symbolism. There's a lot of psychoanalytical discussion about dragons, a lot of mythological discussion about dragons and their significance in stories. Great serpents, beasts of the ancient world.
Highly intelligent.
That haunt us still, and slaying the beast as a symbol of conquering your subconscious fears, also conquering the natural world.
Conquering your literal fears.
What do you think of Thomas viewing the crime through the eyes of the dragon?
Oh, that's such a great question. I mean, I think it's incredibly symbolic. I think King loves to play with juxtaposition. King loves to play with heroes or characters, I should say, who are not your typical or your atypical hero become heroes. I think of Eddie a lot when I think of Thomas, funny enough. I think that Eddie Dean could have become what Thomas became.
A younger brother. Henry was the main show.
Exactly. And so I think he definitely reminds me of that type of character who, you know, has the potential to be great, but that's really in his hands and his decision to make. Yeah, that's a great question.
If we could see things through our serpent brain, what would we see? In the case of Thomas, it is the destruction of the father and the ascension to manhood before you're ready.
Yeah.
The eyes of the dragon are the eyes of immaturity forced to maturity.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Right?
Sure. At least in this case.
And it's telling that he continually goes back to that place to confess.
Over and over again.
And that confession is the reason Dennis starts working to save Peter.
Yeah.
So it's like Thomas needs to confess of the crime. He needs to say, I'm not ready for this. I've been seeing way too much through the eyes of the dragon, which is also to say, the eyes of Flag.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think from that trauma that Thomas actually makes one of the most informed and mature decisions of any character, in that he realizes that he has to exile himself, that he has to go on this journey to re-find himself away from this place. And I think that's really honorable in a certain way, to recognize your faults, recognize where you made mistakes, and realize that you need to atone for those things.
And you can't have two kings.
No, not at all.
You've got to only have one.
Right.
I love it. That's about all I had to say,
you know,
man.
For a 300-page book, I think we did pretty well.
I feel like we covered it.
I think so.
We're going to put a poll about our next book.
Ooh.
So follow us on Twitter.
Yeah, please. And again, if you have any suggestions, if there's a book that you are dying for Derek and I to read, if you have any suggestions at all, please let us know.
because we're going to do every Stephen
King. Yeah, we're doing
King
everyone
book.
Anyway, so.
Yeah, until everyone says stop podcasting. And then even then, I'm going to read every Stephen King book. So.
And we're probably still going to sit in front of these microphones and record it because we love it.
And so, yeah, find us on Twitter. Let us know what you think. If there's something we missed or overlooked or you disagree with in terms of Eyes of the Dragon, mm-hmm. let us know.
Yeah, please do. You know, it's funny. Since we started to Twitter, our own Twitter account outside of the Midnight Myth, we've had a lot of response. And there has been a lot of really eye-opening discussion for both Derek and I while we're reading books. We've gotten suggestions on things to read. We've gotten different perspectives and different opinions, not only on our own episodes, but on the things that we've talked about, different themes in the book that we haven't even picked up on. So Derek and I are constantly looking for your perspective and the way that you view the book, because clearly what we say is our own opinion. It is not gospel by any stretch of the imagination, but we definitely take all of your suggestions seriously. So please fire away.
I love that, because honestly, when we're interpreting art, there's a lot of ways we can go. No one's saying we have the like monolithic, correct perspective on interesting artwork from a genius like Stephen King.
Exactly.
Well, everyone, till next time, long days and pleasant nights.
Long days and pleasant nights.